Your Honor, my name is Howard Phillips. I represent Mr. Jackson Mika, and I appreciate the court allowing us to have oral argument in this case. I flew in from the Virgin Islands specifically to represent my client in this matter.
How much time would you like to reserve?
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Just to give the court some background, Your Honor, my client was Jackson Mika. He went reluctantly to a local nightclub, Jillian's, and... Let me
interrupt you and say we do spend a fair amount of time making sure we're up to speed on the facts, and time is short for you, so
okay.
I would concentrate on the legal argument.
My legal argument, Your Honor, there are basically two. I first want to speak to GameWorks and Gemini, which are the corporate entities involved in this matter, and where we brought a claim for fraudulent conveyance or fraudulent transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. In this case, I think it's pretty clear that what the trial judge did in this case, he heard my circumstantial evidence, and he weighed the circumstantial evidence against the direct evidence that was presented by the proponents of the summary judgment motion. The circumstantial evidence was that Gemini was part of the negligence claim that we initially filed. Gemini was dismissed by Judge Palmer Robinson, and when they were dismissed out of the case, which made sense, it was based on negligence and jurisdiction. So they were a corporation shareholder, so it made sense that they would be dismissed out of the case. 8 days after they were dismissed out of the case, a letter of intent to purchase JBC, which owned JBC Entertainment Holdings,
Let me ask you, though. There was a sale that occurred while the charges were not, the case had been dismissed against both Gemini and GameWorks at the time GameWorks bought the JBC Entertainment.
GameWorks was not an initial defendant, Your Honor. It was only Gemini.
That's correct.
And after Gemini was dismissed.
And then the fraudulent transfer argument was...
We amended the complaint.
As a result of the sale, the proceeds were used to pay off valid liens, were they not?
No, they weren't, Your Honor. If the court looks carefully at the letter of intent, as well as the agreement that was made, the condition of sale was that all encumbrances and liens would be resolved prior to the transfer of the assets, which makes sense. No one buys a house with liens and that sort of thing. And if you look at paragraph 12 of the letter of intent to purchase, that was reflected in there as well. All liens and encumbrances, to include the $1.4 million that was owed to GE Capital, was to be cleared up before the transfer was made. And I believe that was in July. And by October, the actual sale was made. And so our argument, Your Honor, is that no, the $3 million that was paid was free and clear, and it was not encumbered by liens or any sort of
So you're obligation. Saying those liens weren't satisfied out of the proceeds of the sale?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, because that was a part of the – if you look at the letter of intent, that was it. And if you look at the agreement,
show? Were the escrow in front of the trial court?
One of the things that was – no, it was not, Your Honor. That was one of the problems in the case. Apparently, there wasn't – if you look at the documents that were presented by the defendants, those – the only documents that was presented related to the GE. There apparently was another entity that was involved called First Bank that also had some sort of claim secured or otherwise. That bank was not paid off until the following year.
But do you agree that if all the secured creditors were satisfied and that consumed the proceeds, that it's not a fraudulent transaction?
If they
were ahead of your client priority?
If that were the case, Your Honor, but I wanted to point out, Your Honor, that...
But that's the fact that you're arguing. They weren't.
They were not. And in fact, they had three options. The 30B6 witness, Mr. Keyes, testified that they had three options: liquidation, bankruptcy, or the sale. If they had chosen bankruptcy, then my client would have had an opportunity to petition as an unsecured creditor and could have gotten some sort of compensation out of the severe injuries that he suffered. So, no, our argument is that the transferee, that is GameWorks, received this. We transferred the $3 million
in
total.
Do we care where the money actually came from to pay the secured liens, or do we examine the amount of the secured liens and compare it to the fair market value of the encumbered asset?
I think he would do that, Your Honor, if the secured liens were not cleared, the liens were not cleared prior to the purchase. Then you could look, then I think.
Well, were they cleared after the, I'm going to call it, for lack of a better word, the purchase and sale agreement was executed?
One of them was, and that one was not named in the letter of intent, nor was it named in the agreement. The other, the whole notion was all those liens and encumbrances had to be cleared prior to the purchase, which makes sense to me.
Well, and it makes sense to me, but why do we care where the money came from to clear them as long as the amount that would have been needed to clear them exceeds the value of the asset?
We don't really care about that, Your Honor. What we really care about is the purpose of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, and that is to protect creditors from corporations using the corporate structure to deny or hinder, delay, or defraud a potential creditor. My client hadn't received his judgment, but it's pretty, pretty clear from the case law that he still was a potential creditor because he had had made the lawsuit, and the case law is clear. If the assets are given away or transferred prior when there's a threat of a lawsuit, then you have at least a circumstantial evidence. And I guess I can reserve my time to speak to Mr. Humphreys later, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have 4 minutes.
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Aaron Gilligan, and I represent GameWorks Entertainment, LLC. GameWorks asks that the court affirm the summary judgment dismissal of GameWorks. There were two claims that were asserted against GameWorks. One was under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That claim was properly dismissed for multiple reasons that's in our briefing, but primarily the court can easily dispose of this case because the assets that were transferred were subject to a valid secured lien, and that's the only evidence in the record. And the court can direct its attention to the declaration of Matthew Kleiss, where he clearly explains how this transaction happened. There were secured liens held by GE Capital and Fifth Third Bank, and the proceeds from the sale, pursuant to his declarations, demonstrates that those proceeds didn't even fully pay back the secured lenders. So, Mr. Mika,
do we care how the secured lenders got paid back? Is that part of our analysis?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The plain language of the Uniform Transfer Fraudulent Transfer Act states that the act is not applicable to the transfer of assets and that are subject to a valid secured lien, and that's what we have in this case.
I think the argument is at the time of the transfer, at least some of the assets were not subject to a lien because the lien had already been paid off at the time of the transfer.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what the support for that is in the record. As I understand it, that the assets that were, or the proceeds from this transaction, were used to satisfy secured liens.
Is there any evidence that any of the secured interests were paid before the purchase and sale agreement was executed?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. With regard to the successor liability claim that the plaintiff asserted, Judge Downing got it right in dismissing that claim, because in Washington, the general rule is that a purchasing corporation is not subject to the debts and liabilities of the previous corporation unless one of four exceptions apply. And none of the exceptions apply here. Mr. Mika asserts that it was a fraudulent transfer that justifies imposing successor liability. But what we have in the record is a clear demonstration that you have two separate entities negotiating at arm's length for valid, legitimate business purposes.
Is there any evidence that the amount that was paid was or was not fair value for the
There is no evidence. There was the sale was for $3 million, and it's uncontested that that was a fair market value for the assets at issue.
Is there evidence that that was a fair market value from some witness?
I'm not aware of an expert witness that testified on that issue, but certainly there was no challenge on that issue.
Well, it's the initial moving party. You have the burden of proving by some evidence that there's no genuine issue material fact as to the various elements of the claim, correct? Or you can assert the lack of evidence on the part of the other side.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What did you offer to the court to show that this was a fair market value transaction?
I believe we have the declarations from Matthew Keis, who was a partner in Gemini, and perhaps Gemini can address the issue a little bit more. And then from GameWorks, we have Howard.
You know, the 10 minutes is for you collectively, not for.
That's correct. And perhaps I should reserve the remainder of the time, unless Your Honors have any questions specifically related to GameWorks. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Pete Talovich of K&L Gates on behalf of Gemini. I'd like to focus our brief time on some of the issues raised by Mr. Phillips. The timing of the sale came first. The proceeds of the sale were necessary and were used to pay off the secured lien. That's at Clerk's Papers 318, paragraph 8. There was total secured debt of $6 million. The proceeds of the sale of JBC Entertainment's assets were used to satisfy these obligations. Not in full. Some remaining cash collateral posted by the investors themselves needed to pay off the second lender. And that goes to Mr. Phillips' argument and the court's question about whether there was fair value. There was every incentive for Gemini to get the highest value that it could on this failing investment, because whatever they didn't get paid from the proceeds of the sale would be owed to the second secured lender, Fifth Third Bank. Fifth Third Bank would recover against the proceeds of the sale, and they got about 20% after GE Capital was paid off. And the remaining actually came from cash collateral that the investors had to give to Fifth Third.
Investors' principals in Gemini?
Yes, it was the three shareholders of Gemini, and Gemini is a minority shareholder of Holdings, JBC Entertainment Holdings, which is the parent of JBC Entertainment, which is the parent of JBC of Seattle, the actual operator here. Mr. Phillips states that there actually could have been some value from him if Gemini had thrown this into bankruptcy. As Mr. Keis's declaration states, bankruptcy would not have helped him at all, and actually would have been a worse option. They would have had to sell off these assets. They had a uniquely positioned buyer who could actually integrate this into their existing restaurant and gaming operations, and they did so. Bankruptcy would have obviously, Your Honor, still been subject to these two secured liens. And again, the record's very clear that these liens were fully secured. Otherwise, it wouldn't have come out of the cash collateral. Again,
the question was, what established the value of the property that was subject to the collateral so that we know it was fully collateralized or over in burden?
I don't think there's any independent evidence in the record of the actual value of the property that was sold, like an appraisal or an expert, as Your Honor stated. The outstanding secured debt was $6 million. The property sold for $3 million. These five establishments, actually, I don't believe there was real property involved. It was just the restaurants themselves.
So there isn't anything other than the fact that the company ponied up the balance on the debt it owed?
The company ponied up the balance on the debt it owed, and it had every incentive to get the highest price for it, because the remaining, what they didn't get, would have come out of the initial investor's pocket. Now, even if there's some question about whether the badges of fraud applies here, and that's Mr. Mika's primary argument. There's two other reasons that the claim fails as a matter of law. Mr. Gilligan stated the asset sale was not a transfer under the statute. And against Gemini, Mika was not a creditor. You heard Mr. Phillips admit that actually it made sense in the beginning that Gemini was dismissed from the case. They were a shareholder. But the whole purpose of Mr. Phillips asserting that Mika has a claim was the fraudulent transfer itself, the purported fraudulent transfer itself. So at that transfer, he admits they didn't have a claim. Mr. Mika was not a creditor, and the transfer was perfectly valid. If no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time to the final counsel.
Mr. Talovich, Your Honor, my name is Peter Sutherland. I represent Tony Humphreys. This is a separate issue from what we've just been discussing. This has to do with liability for the underlying shooting, and my client is regional director or a multi-unit manager of the parent company, JVC Entertainment Holdings.
There's no evidence he was ever a director or officer?
There is no evidence that he was ever a director or officer, Your Honor. That it is in his title, but it is...
A different use of the word.
It is a different use of the word, and he is an employee. And that is unrebutted in the record. I would just simply, in the limited time I have, want to remind the court that we're talking about inferring a duty on him to protect Mr. Mika from the assault of an unknown entity. And courts are very reluctant to expand and stretch that duty to include third parties in that circumstance. The holder of the property, you know, when we look at cases like Nivens versus 7-Eleven, that is the premises, that is the business. And nowhere does that duty expand to include employees unless there's some specific duty, contract, or law that's placed on that individual. I would think of a truck driver, for example. The rules of the road impose that duty. There is nothing here in which this panel can stretch that rule or stretch the exception in which to...
Well, the argument is it's with his duty to develop a safety plan. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's one of the arguments, but again, where in the record does it establish that it is his duty? The record shows that local management... the local companies, in this case Jillian's, JBC of Seattle, was responsible for the day-to-day operations of the restaurant. That would include knowledge and application of local ordinances. And I'd also point out that safety management, the safety management requirement says nothing about the security protocols that he insists needed to be in place on March 20th. There's nothing there that says you shall have purse searches, you shall have wands.
I think you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Your Honor, under the corporate responsible officer doctrine, Mr. Humphreys was in fact the director of operations. Mr. Warfield was the president of JBC, which is the parent company. He was the direct supervisor of Mr. Humphreys. He testified in his deposition that Humphreys was in fact the director of operations. When Mr. Humphreys testified in his deposition,
is that how the corporate liability doctrine uses the word director?
Director is an officer, Your Honor.
Isn't a director a member of the board of directors? That's the highest level of governance of a corporation.
Well, I guess you could say that, Your Honor, but the truth of the matter is he was a corporate officer. He was a director. Counsel here just said, well, he was just a manager.
What corporate office did he hold?
Director of operations, Your Honor. Regional director of operations, in fact. He directed several stores, three of which were in the West Coast, and he was director of five. My point is, Your Honor, that during his deposition, Counsel says there was no evidence of it. He described the duty of a director of operations. Then he and I asked him, well, then, are you the director of operations? And he said yes. That sounds to me like evidence. So not only did Mr. Warwick, his supervisor, say he was the director of operations, he himself said he was the director of operations. So I think that was important. That's important, Your Honor, because the president also says that he, as the director of operations, is also responsible for the local ordinances and peculiarities of each org. This is a national corporation. So they had to rely on some officer, some director, or someone to deal with and comply with local ordinances, one of which was the safety plan of Seattle, Washington.
What does the record tell us about what a safety plan would have done to prevent what happened here?
What a safety plan would have done to prevent here, would do that didn't happen in this case, Your Honor, is make the defendants think, or the nightclub think about it didn't lay out, you should have to do this, you should have to do this, but it makes them think about patron safety. I was, in fact, on the board with on a committee meeting with Judge Sharon Armstrong when we were deciding whether to have metal detectors in the courtroom at King County Superior Court. I, myself, because I wanted to maintain the decorum of a court and safety, appearance of safety in a court, said we shouldn't have that. When, in fact, the Blackwell shooting occurred thereafter and there was a fatal shooting, and I quickly changed my mind, and now you cannot enter a court without having to go through metal detectors. Other nightclubs in this area, similar nightclubs playing similar music, Your Honor, the simple, easy, inexpensive thing of wanding people, checking for purses, that sort of thing is done by other nightclubs. It was Mr. Humphreys, as a regional director and personally involved with this club, did in fact gave no directives. Mr. Knutson, who was the managing director, who lied that night, in fact, said the shooting occurred outside. He said that he has not been trained in any security measures at all. There's no security measures. He didn't even know how to evacuate his patients in case of fire. So the safety plan, Your Honor, makes nightclubs think about, well, what safety precautions should be in place to protect our people? That's what would have happened, and the weapon more likely than not would have not have been brought into the incident. Lastly, Your Honor, I wanted to talk about the promotion because that seems to be a big deal by the case, whether this was a promotion or not. The promotion was, in fact, supposed to be this rapper, Lloyd, was supposed to come to the nightclub after he had performed a concert for his after party. There is no evidence that he had even arrived. So the promotion that a big do had been made of didn't even occur because Mr. Lloyd hadn't even arrived. This was just a full nightclub. It could have happened on any weekend, promotion or not, when they were playing dance music. While the dance music was playing, shots were fired. My client was hit in the butt, and the courts know the circumstances that occurred after that. The court have any more questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you all. That would take us to